It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden signed an executive order on abortion access. We'll learn more about what the action does and doesn't do for reproductive rights. First, a U.S. district judge last week sentenced former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin to serve 21 years in federal prison for violating George Floyd's civil rights. He's already been serving time after being found guilty of murdering Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9.5 minutes. But there's a lot more to George Floyd's story. Two reporters from the Washington Post spent more than a year trying to reconstruct his life for a new book. They interviewed friends, family, people who knew him and loved him. They walked his streets, went where he went, to be able to tell the full story of the man whose killing on May 25th, 2020, inspired a summer of racial justice protests. They also wanted to better understand the policies affecting African Americans that can be linked to Floyd winding up in Minneapolis, unemployed, and battling addiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been reflecting on the 2 years since the killing of George Floyd? Where do you see the racial justice movement it inspired making progress? What more do you think needs to be done to make a real difference at the local, state, or federal level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tolu Olurunipa is a national reporter for The Washington Post. He's co-author of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Dean.
And Robert Samuels is a national reporter for The Post. He's the other co-author of His Name is George Floyd. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean.
This book was a real journey for both of you. You covered hundreds of miles, did hundreds of interviews. Tolu, I want to start with you. What motivated you to take this approach, to put in the work, and create a really intimate portrait of George Floyd?
Well, this all started with a series that we did in the Washington Post back in 2020, where we wanted to find out more about George Floyd's life, not just the video that everyone saw of him dying, but we wanted to find out what it was like for him to live in America as a Black man, as someone who grew up poor, and as someone who faced systemic racism and the suffocating pressure of institutional injustice from the time he was born, even decades and centuries before he was born, when we talk about his family. And we did that series and saw that there was so much more to his story. And we decided to spend a little bit more time digging more deeply into his background and into the events that happened after his death in 2021. And we were able to formulate that into a book in which we were able to tell not only the story of one man's life, but also the story of America, the story of the Black American experience, and show how the injustices that George Floyd faced in his death and during his life reflect what so many other people face. And it showed how, you know, his striving and his efforts to try to live a better life, and stumbling and struggling and having issues of his own and trying to overcome his past as part of the American experience, as part of the American story. And we wanted to show how his experience differed from the experience of other people who may have gotten a little bit more grace in their lives than he did. And we thought that might be able to reflect a little bit about how institutional racism works in the 21st century.
And in order to tell the story in that way, you had to really be on the ground with his family, with his friends, building trust and relationships. Robert, I know one person you spent a lot of time with was Maurice Hall, someone he was with on the day he was killed, and a lot of other friends and contacts of George Floyd. How did you go about establishing contact and building that trust?
We worked really hard for it because we knew this was a world that could be pretty unforgiving for people to tell the truth and to tell their full story. And we also knew there was a lot of skepticism. What we told people when we started thinking about this project was that we were not so interested in how George Floyd died. We wanted to tell the story of how he lived, but even more so, we wanted to let the world know and understand how systemic racism works in America. Maurice Hall, who was with George Floyd on the day he died, he drove with him to Cup Foods. He did not speak on the stand, but he talked to us because he believed in the mission. And so when we began this conversation, it really was bedrocked with this simple idea. One, do you believe that systemic racism exists? Two, Do you want to do your part to help eradicate it? Because as a journalist, I think it's anti-democratic and I want to do my part. And so we asked them to join with us in this process through not just telling his story, but to make sure that at every turn, we looked at George Floyd's life with the right nuance and context, but we also told the story of the country in hopes that there might not be another George Floyd.
And I want to take a brief stop before we talk about George Floyd's life to talk about that of his great-great-grandfather, because you include a chapter in the book about Hillary Thomas Stewart, who at one point, after being born enslaved, grew to own over 500 acres of land in North Carolina. That's an inheritance that, hypothetically, George Floyd would have been born into. That wasn't the case, though. Talu, can you talk about what happened in the 1800s?
Yeah, I'm so glad you put it that way, because Hillary Thomas Stewart wanted to pass down his land to his descendants. He had been born enslaved, and he knew that coming into the world with nothing, and as many of his own ancestors did, leaving with nothing was not the way to do it. So as soon as he got his freedom, he saw that there was value in being able to work the land. He worked very hard with his large family and was able to amass through hard work 500 acres of land in North Carolina, making him one of the wealthiest Black men in his community at the time in the late 1800s. But at that time, it was a time of racial terror, and people did not like the fact that a Black man was wealthy in his community at the time, wealthier than many white people in his community. And they essentially had him dealt with. They used unscrupulous business deals and, you know, fake and fraudulent tax authorities decided to strip him of all of his land before he could make any transfers to his descendants. And as a result, all of his future generations ended up poor, and they worked hard and they worked as sharecroppers because they didn't have anything that they owned on their own. And even George Floyd's mother came into the world and she worked as a sharecropper in North Carolina. And that's part of the reason George Floyd came into the world poor, not just poor, but in deep poverty, living in a house without electricity and without houses. And the deep poverty of the American South is how he entered into the world. And his mother decided she wanted to leave North Carolina to relocate to Texas to try to get a better stance on life. But essentially, his family worked in North Carolina for more than two centuries, worked very hard. And despite all that hard work, he wasn't able to inherit any of that. And he came into the world essentially with an understanding that everything that you work for can be stripped away from you, like it was stripped away from his ancestors. And that's a very difficult way to experience the American dream and to experience, all of the promise of the land of opportunity. And we saw the reverberations of that as George Floyd came into the world and tried to make a way for himself, growing up as a poor Black boy in the 1970s and 1980s.
We're talking with Talu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels right now, co-authors of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. And Talu, you spent a lot of time in Houston talking with Floyd's family, visiting his schools. What kind of portrait emerged to you of George Floyd growing up in Houston?
Yeah, he was a resident of Houston's Third Ward. He was well known in his community. This is a historically African-American community. It was designed to be segregated, but it's also a proud community, a very close-knit community. And George Floyd was someone who had stature because he came up in part because of his size and because of his diligence in pursuing athletics. He was well known in his community. He started off in third grade, and we talked to his teacher. He wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, and he was doing well in school early on. But as he got older and as he got taller, people realized that if he was going to try to make it out, they told him essentially that he should try sports. He should try to focus on athletics because he had this big athletic body and build. And he was doing pretty well in sports, but his academics fell behind as he attended a number of underfunded schools, and that made it hard for him to have a solid foundation to try to get to college. He did eventually go to college, but he had to drop out because his educational foundation was not strong enough. And as a result, his athletic dreams fell apart as well. And then that left him coming back to Houston as someone who didn't have a college degree, didn't have a sports contract, and had a number of issues in trying to prepare and protect his family and provide for them. And that led him down some dark choices and the dark path of criminality, and the criminal justice system was waiting for him. But one of the things we found out about George Floyd was, despite the fact that he made mistakes and despite the fact that the system was very unforgiving towards him, he was always willing to pick himself up, strive for a better life. It's part of the reason he left Houston late in life to move to Minneapolis, to go to rehab, to try to get clean, to try to get a job and provide for his family. So he was always someone who was like that. He was always trying to, put the past behind him and reach for a better future. And he always had that optimism. He was someone that went around saying, "I love you" to everyone because he wanted to spread that level of optimism around him, even when he was in a dark place, even when he made the mistakes that he later regretted. He always had that optimistic spirit that things would get better in the future.
And Robert, how does that compare or contrast with the Floyd that you learned about in Minneapolis, who arrived trying to reset his life a few years before his death? What did you learn about him there?
Well, George Floyd followed the path of his mother, right? Who we talked about leaving a system that was not built for her to succeed. And he found the same thing in Texas, where after he comes out of prison with the badge of a former felon, ex-felon, he can't get a professional license, which is needed for 1 in 3 jobs in Texas. He couldn't become even a barber if he wanted to. So he boards a bus and he heads to Minneapolis because he hears the stories from his friends. We talk more about it in the book, about how people in Minneapolis, it's a more progressive city, they have a heart for people like him. He goes through a rehab program focused specifically on trying to heal Black men. And at first, he's doing pretty well. He gets a job, he gets a second job, he gets a girlfriend, he gets a nice townhome to rent with one of his friends from rehab. But the sad part about this, Dean, is that despite all those steps, the institutions that have the residue of racism still stuck in them continue to almost conspire against George Floyd. When he one day walks in and finds his roommate overdosed, he's then sent back into a world of depression and drug dependency without many systems that understood where he was coming from. And from then, he continually tried to build his life all the way up to May 2020, when he lost his job as a security guard because the coronavirus had struck. 1 in 2 African Americans in Minnesota were unemployed. He was unemployed because the place where he worked was closed down, and he gets the virus himself. And so he's there trying to figure out a way to make sense of the world and continue that optimism that Tolu had alluded to on May 25th, 2020, which is the day the world learned the name George Floyd because he had encountered Derek Chauvin.
We're talking with Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa right now, national reporters for The Washington Post and co-authors of the book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the summer of 2020 and the aftermath of George Floyd's killing? How are you reflecting on that period and where the country is now? Do you think progress has been made and what work still needs to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa, co-authors of the book His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Tolu, last week, we got the news that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 21 years in prison for violating George Floyd's rights. I want to get your thoughts on Derek Chauvin and how that sentencing kind of has you thinking about the story that you're telling in the book. I know you have an entire chapter on Derek Chauvin in the book.
Yes, we did spend a lot of time delving into Derek Chauvin's past, his own personal history, his professional history as a police officer, because we wanted to find out more about why he did what he did. Everyone saw the video. They saw the callous nature and callous disregard for George Floyd's humanity. And they wanted to find out, we wanted to find out why he did that, how his training led him to that level of force to be used. And we found out that he used that kind of force regularly on a regular basis. And now that we've seen this most recent guilty plea in which he pled guilty to not only violating George Floyd's civil rights, but the civil rights of a 14-year-old boy who he hit with a flashlight and also used the neck restraint against. We document that case in the book. We also document several other cases of Derek Chauvin using the neck restraint against people who fit a number of different categories. Some of them were young children. Some of them were older. In almost every case, he used the excuse that they were bigger than he was, and he wanted to subdue them because of their size. And many times that involved him using a level of force that was more than what his colleagues on the force were using. He was known, and his precinct was known as being thumpers, in the words of people in the community who said that they would go and use force and then ask questions later. And we found that Derek Chauvin seemed to be of that mold and built in that mold. And that was sort of how he came up in the police force. And he was in that very same mold when he met George Floyd on May 25th, 2020. And rather than, using a little bit of grace and allowing George Floyd to breathe, he decided to essentially say that what he was doing was protocol, that he had called an ambulance and that everything would be okay as long as he just continued to keep his knee on George Floyd's neck. We wanted to be able to show that this was not an anomaly. This was not just a bad day. This was a culture of policing that had been built up in the Minneapolis Police Department, specifically in the third precinct and within Derek Chauvin, who had been on the force for 19 years. And he had spent a lot of time using these similar tactics and the similar level of force without being reprimanded, without being held accountable. We wanted to show that this is a systemic issue, not just one bad apple in a police department. And there are police departments all across the country that have these issues, and there's a push to try to reform some of that. But it's very deeply entrenched, and it was important for us to show that Derek Chauvin represents something larger than just one individual cop on one bad day.
And after George Floyd's killing, his family, especially his brother Philonis, became part of the racial justice movement that sprung up afterward. Robert, what did you hear from his family, his relatives and loved ones about the person they knew being an icon of racial justice?
It's a very strange path for them to see their brother and their nephew or their uncle. Most of his family called him Perry. Almost reduced to murals and hashtags because he was so much more than that. They knew him as a full person. In the book, we recount a story with Philonis and Joe Biden, and Philonis tells President Biden, "What we have to do is remember that my brother was more than a video." Now, I think it's also important to remember, Dean, that this family, because of their history, had always believed that the way to make it in America was to keep your head down, provide for your family, get a good job, not cause too much trouble. But when they saw the pernicious force of racism strike against their brother in his murder, they realized that that could not be the solution for their family. And so many of them stepped out, joined the call for racial justice, even though it was uncomfortable for them. We recount a scene in the book a little bit after Jacob Blake's death, where Philonis is trying to speak to a crowd and completely breaks down. But I think what we'd want viewers, and we hope readers, would take away from this book is that the Floyd's experience tells us something about how racism operates in the United States, right? That keeping one's head down, trying to ignore it, just trying to provide for your own would not be enough to prevent terrible things from happening. And it could happen to you, whether you're Black or white. Derek Chauvin was also molded by these same systems. And so the realization that the Floyd family is documented going through in the course of the pages of the book is a type of realization that we hope would echo in the hearts of readers.
And Talu, whether it's civil rights activists or Floyd's own family that took part in the movement, what points of action are you seeing, progress or inaction, in the 2 years since his death?
Well, there definitely has been some progress and change as a result of George Floyd's death and the uprising that took place of people taking to the streets to protest what they saw as a grave injustice. So we have seen a number of different states pass bans on chokeholds by police, bans on no-knock warrants, bans on a number of aggressive policing tactics. There was a push to try to get that same level of action at the federal level so that nationwide there will be certain standards. Unfortunately, for the activists who wanted those laws to be passed and for members of George Floyd's family who pushed very strongly for that George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to be passed by Congress and signed by President Biden, the talks around that bill essentially ended in a stalemate, and there was no federal bill to be passed. Now, Joe Biden, the president, did sign an executive order a couple of months ago in which he tried to implement some of these policies through his own executive power. But, you know, there is a feeling among the activists that rather than, you know, this great social justice movement leading to major civil rights legislation, instead, we have seen a backlash. We've seen, you know, a shortcoming in terms of the kinds of major changes that were expected. And there is a push to try to get more done, even in the face of this backlash, which comes in the form of people talking about critical race theory and saying that we shouldn't be talking about race as much as we should. And so there's this feeling that the struggle continues. And even as some of the momentum that was around George Floyd's death has faded, there's still a push to try to get something done and to try to continue the struggle for racial justice for the future.
We'll leave it there. Talu, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Robert Samuels is a National Enterprise reporter for The Post, one of the co-authors of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We were also joined by co-author Talu Olorunipa. Coming up after the news, a reproductive rights professor joins us to look at President Biden's executive order on abortion access, which aims to expand protections for things like contraception pills, abortion medication, and more. We'll look at what it does and doesn't do, and the other options the administration has following the overturning of Roe v. Wade. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the founders of a Buy Nothing group in Appleton, where members request things they need and give away things they no longer do. Now, President Biden signed an executive order last week that aims to add more protections for women seeking abortions following the overturn of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court.
I'm asking the Justice Department that, much like they did in the civil rights era, to do something, do everything in their power to protect these women seeking to invoke their rights. In states where clinics are still open, to protect them from intimidation, to protect the right of women to travel from state that prohibits seeking the medical attention that she needs to a state to provide that care.
The order focuses on medication abortion, emergency contraceptives, and patient privacy. It directs the Department of Health and Human Services to take up the charge. Abortion rights advocates and some Democrats say the order doesn't go far enough, and they're calling for the Biden administration to do more to protect reproductive rights. Opponents are accusing Biden of trying to circumvent the Supreme Court's ruling. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this executive order from the White House? Do you want the president to do more for abortion access, or should he leave it up to Congress and the states? If you work in reproductive health care, we'd love to hear from you. What are you seeing right now? What do you think people should know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, could you tell us a bit more about what is in this executive order and what stands out to you as you looked at it?
Yeah, so the executive order has quite a bit in it that's worth noting. First is the Biden administration is trying to clarify health privacy protections, what HIPAA enforcement actually requires to limit the free flow of information of people who may be seeking abortion. It also provides technical and monetary assistance to healthcare providers to clarify and to help provide access to contraception, including emergency contraception, as well as putting funding towards a public education campaign to let people know what their reproductive rights are. In addition to that, in the clip that was played, the Biden administration made it very clear that they're also looking to protect the safety of clinics, which is a top priority right now as anti-abortion activists continually try and target these clinics for their own efforts. The final piece is that the executive order clarifies that for federal workers, their paid sick leave does include taking sick days to travel for any healthcare needs they may have, including those related to accessing abortion.
And in general, how much of a difference do you think this could make for people needing reproductive health services or abortions, particularly in places where they might now be illegal? Do you think this makes a big difference?
Unfortunately, I think it only tackles anything that's on the real margins. Take, for example, the HIPAA privacy protections. The executive order clarifies that it's only if there's a court order can a medical provider release somebody's medical records, including anything related to post-abortion care. That does mean that the medical professional can't just volunteer that information, but in states that are very determined to go after and to charge people with abortion-related crimes, it's not going to be much to stand in the way of it. So unfortunately, people who can't access abortion in the states that have the strictest laws will still be left without this option to control their reproductive health.
On that privacy front, this order also asks the Federal Trade Commission to explore privacy protections for data online and on period tracking apps, too. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the concerns there that it's trying to address?
One of the earliest social media points that came up post the leaking of the Dobbs draft was that period tracking apps could very well be subpoenaed by law enforcement officials and be used to demonstrate that somebody could be pregnant and then seek not to be pregnant. I think that some privacy experts have shown that privacy tracking is probably the least of the worries because there's already widespread precedent to subpoena phone records, subpoena text messages, and any search engine queries that somebody has made. And so the FTC can, and I think as you said, is empowered by this executive order to investigate these privacy protections. But as with anything dealing with law enforcement, whenever there are state crimes that are being investigated, there is a wide berth of leeway given to what it is that can be requested. Now, these internet service providers, sites like Google, can always turn down these requests, but those protracted legal battles speak to a whole other set of issues and the larger problem of a chilling effect of people being able to seek the care that they need will remain.
The order also asks the Department of Health and Human Services to identify ways to protect access to medical abortions, abortion pills, so-called. Could you talk about how those have been regulated differently than surgical abortions and why they have kind of fallen outside of the scope of the Supreme Court's decision?
Medication abortions are controlled largely by a decision made by the Food and Drug Administration about 20 years ago when they found that mifepristone is safe for use as part of producing an abortion. And so the Biden administration and Merrick Garland, in particular, even before this executive order, made it very clear that medication abortions could not be banned totally from the state because states cannot override FDA authority. That's been true for the past 22 years. But what we've seen in practice is when states like Texas have passed laws that ban the use of medication for abortion after 7 weeks, there hasn't really been any effort on the part of the federal government or the Justice Department to contest the legality of those laws. So the push here to investigate whether or not medication abortions could still be available for people in states that have the most severe restrictions is showing one path forward, but one that may be very limited, given that a physician may be very reticent to prescribe medication abortion in these states with the most severe restrictions.
We're talking with Claire McKinney right now, an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary, about the White House's executive order aiming to protect some access to reproductive health services after the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hey there.
What did you want to bring up, Jack?
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say that on the whole, there's a lot I don't know about the process for women to obtain access to the healthcare and the services they need. But I will just say that someone's, you know, trying to get an abortion, they're pregnant, like they have the right, I believe, to do whatever it takes to, you know, safely and ethically get that abortion. And so, you know, that being said, there's, again, a lot I don't know about how to obtain such a procedure. And so I guess my question is, what is the Biden administration doing that will have the best short-term effects, if you will, you know, in light of Roe being overturned and given what the president and his administration can do to increase women's access to abortion, again, in light of the quagmire that we now have with Roe v. Wade having been overturned.
Gotcha. Jack, thanks for the call. Claire, to Jack's point of short-term solutions for women seeking abortion access, what are you seeing out there?
I think that the Biden administration is really hamstrung in what they could do to provide practical access for people who live in states that are determined to eliminate access to abortion. As Dobbs v. Jackson and the Supreme Court has made very clear, they think that abortion is an issue to be left to the states. And until there is federal legislation that preempts state law, only at the very margins can there be any protection of access. And so I think that the two things that stand out to me and the executive order that provide the most kind of tangible in the moment points of access are this guarantee that federal workers can use their healthcare benefits to travel to states where abortion is legal, and that they are really pushing for money given to healthcare providers to expand access to emergency contraceptives. That isn't the same thing as an abortion, but contraceptive access is going to be even more important now that people cannot make the full range of choices concerning their reproductive health.
And one other aspect of this order is seeking to convene more pro bono legal representation for healthcare providers that might be charged with providing an abortion. Now, here in Wisconsin, Both the clinics that provided abortion services have ceased doing so because of an 1849 law that has been seen as going back in effect after the Supreme Court's ruling. Is that legal representation part of this order kind of symbolic, or are there parts of the country where this could be more contentious and put into use?
I think that we're going to see quite a bit of contention about what the post Roe v. Wade world actually looks like. And so I do think that it's notable that seeking to provide a guarantee or at least provide access to legal representation exists. If we look to what the political world looked like before Roe v. Wade, one of the things that really sparked public attention to the need to reform very restrictive abortion laws was the fact that physicians who were providing abortion that they thought was necessary medical care were being prosecuted. This happened in DC, this happened in California, and it was through the courage of particular physicians willing to say that this was necessary medical care that we got to see a sea change in how people viewed abortion. And we really see part of the movement for abortion rights taking off in that period, in part because of this alliance between physicians and lawyers who pushed for changes in the law and changes so that they could provide the care that they needed. That might be our future going forward. I think right now we're in an intense period where the uncertainty is actually leading to people being overly cautious. So hopefully this pro bono representation will encourage the same sort of courage that we saw in the 1960s.
We're talking with College of William & Mary Government Professor Claire McKinney about President Biden's executive order regarding reproductive health services last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the president taking some action through this executive order? What questions do you have about what it does and doesn't do? Are you concerned about privacy protections when it comes to people seeking reproductive health? Are there other ways you want to see the Biden administration address abortion access? What about Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Claire McKinney. She's an assistant professor of government at the College of William & Mary, who researches abortion law and politics. She's with us today looking at President Biden's executive order on abortions and other pathways for federal reproductive rights. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Andrew in Eagle, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. I just had a quick question for you, just regarding where in the Constitution the so-called authority for the federal government to intervene in the abortion issue arises from, because looking at Article 1, Section 8, it lays out all the authority that Congress has, and abortion appears nowhere in there, nor does murder or anything else. And then you look at the 9th and 10th Amendments, and both of those amendments state that whatever is not mentioned within the Constitution is to be left up to the states and to the states alone.
Gotcha. Andrew, thanks for the call. And of course, the Supreme Court's decision returned control over abortion law to the states, but it's not exactly entirely clear that it's only a state issue. Claire, what are you seeing in terms of the boundaries between federal and state power?
So the original decision in Roe v. Wade found the protection to be found in privacy rights. So yes, we find that as articulated in Griswold v. Connecticut in what was called the penumbra, which means the kind of the shadow of the Bill of Rights, the Third Amendment, the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, all find some notion of private liberty as something that is protected, even if it's not enumerated. Feminists have often called for seeing this in the 14th Amendment in the Equal Protection Clause, given the profound effects unwanted pregnancy have on the class status of women. Absent access to abortion, what we see is women, because of their gender and because of how their gender is associated with reproduction, is a way to condemn them to second-class citizenship. That notion of equality has been articulated in the early 1970s in a court case in Illinois that did not get taken up later on. There's also legal scholars who say that we might want to look to the 13th Amendment and the prohibition on forced labor. If we think about pregnancy as the forced gestation against one's will, that is labor that the body is doing. And so some have toyed with the idea of thinking about how refusing the body's forced labor in gestation and in pregnancy could be a site for articulating this. All that being said, the Dobbs decision said that there is no private liberty right to abortion, much as the caller suggested, and it said it dismissed very quickly any equal protection grounds. And so this is why many people are arguing for the need for Congress to codify the protections of abortion and to move around away from the kind of question of constitutional right.
And just to clarify, what congressional pathway does or doesn't exist to codify Roe, it would require eliminating the filibuster in the Senate. Is that correct? And what is the lay of the land with that prospect?
I think it would be near impossible to get any codification of Roe v. Wade. There was a bill, I believe it was titled the Women's Health Protection Act, that Chuck Schumer kind of put forward, and it was defeated. Both, you know, the fact that Manchin wouldn't sign on to the original bill means that there's not even a 50-vote threshold for the most basic protections of people's access to abortion. And so even the elimination of the filibuster, which the Biden administration has now said that it supports for issues around abortion, as well as the issue around voting rights, doesn't seem to get over the fact that there is not a majority of votes in the Senate to actually codify Roe at the moment.
And Claire, I know that you are very interested in the healthcare side of this question. Last time we spoke on the show, it was after the draft of this decision leaked. We were anticipating kind of a scramble to see where things fell, where states went in terms of what they would allow doctors to do or not to do. What are some of the open questions you see right now for healthcare providers across the country?
We see a lot of anecdotes of pharmacies refusing to fulfill prescriptions that include drugs that can serve as abortifacients, that is, drugs that can produce abortions if somebody is pregnant. So I think that the chilling effect that we're seeing practically is even worse than maybe some had intended. For the broader kind of healthcare landscape, we're really kind of struggling to see, and I think a lot of clinics are shutting down preemptively because of this. One thing that's notable is we did see the Whole Women's Health Care, which was at the center of a previous lawsuit that made its way to the Supreme Court, announced that they are going to shut down their clinics in Texas and move across the border to New Mexico. And so I think that we'll see more and more of these kind of border crossings as we continue to see the fallout of and the legal ramifications of the decision.
There's been calls from some progressive Democrats and reproductive rights advocates to say, hey, President Biden, do some more here, even going as far to say, use federal lands to establish abortion clinics and access. The White House has rejected that idea. But what are some of the other ideas on the table that you think the administration could explore or that you might expect to see in the coming months?
I think one of the issues that will be really pressing is protecting any right to interstate travel. I think it's going to be very difficult to get any short-term traction on ensuring access to abortion in the most restrictive states. And states like Missouri have already been toying with eliminating interstate travel as a right for anybody seeking an abortion. So I think on the federal level, this is certainly something that can be and regulated fairly easily. There's a lot of court precedent to say that the federal government does have jurisdiction when we're talking about interstate travel and interstate commerce.
Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin said after the Supreme Court's ruling that it was going to be shifting its attention to providing people with access and with resources to get appointments in other states. Is that similar to what you've seen around the country in states where abortion is now illegal?
Yes, I think the most established organizations are simultaneously trying to shield themselves from any legal action against them, as well as trying to serve as best they can, given those legal parameters. You see more kind of civil disobedient action coming from grassroots organizations that are seeking to provide direct access to medication abortion or surgical abortion through things like, you know, having ships in international waters and things like the Gulf of Mexico. So we're seeing really the tracks open wide for what's available for interested in providing access to abortion, even in the midst of the legal turmoil.
Well, we'll leave it there. Claire, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary, who researches gender, politics, and reproduction in America. She was with us today looking at the federal abortion protections and President Biden's executive order on reproductive rights this last week. You can still let us know what you're thinking about this by emailing ideas@WPR.org. Do you want to see more from the White House? Are you happy with the executive order from last week? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a Supreme Court decision this month allowed a high school football coach to pray on the field with his team. We'll talk about what impact that could have on the separation of church and state in a school setting. Plus, community marching bands are out and about during the summertime. We'll talk with the city band director about the tradition, and you can shout out your local band. That's coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Last Friday, we listened back to a conversation with a UW-Milwaukee film professor about foreign language movies, and a lot of you called in with your own favorites. Get out your pen and paper. Joseph from Green Bay says The City of Lost Children, a French independent film, is really impressive. Jim in Cedarburg recommends the Russian war movie 72 Hours. Sarah in Madison says the French and Dutch film The Vanishing. I will second that, Sarah. That's a very creepy but a really good movie. Rob in Madison said Delicatessen from France is a beautiful dystopian film. And I will get in on the action myself with a couple I've seen recently. Ivan's Childhood, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky, and Knights of Cabiria from Federico Fellini. Not necessarily happy films, but really good ones. So thanks everyone for sharing those picks. Hopefully that'll get your next movie night off to a good start. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.